Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Nice to be with you this morning. I missed you. It is Tuesday, January 23rd, and I am excited about this hour. Got Dr. David Stevens coming up with us in just a few minutes, and then Ron Deal is going to be with us. I had a friend of mine send me a picture from his balcony at the Four Seasons in Maui, and he said, "Enjoy the snowstorm." So I summed up all of my Christian love and said, we're no longer friends. I'm just going to make it easy. It is, I guess that we had a little over 12 inches of snow here in the Twin Cities. So wherever you are, I hope you survived the storm or the inclement weather. I know in Iowa, they were getting tons of rain, and all across the upper Midwest, we got blasted with the snow. Actually, it was kind of pretty. And if you got out and found yourself stuck in a road, you probably found somebody else stuck in a road, and maybe you helped each other. I was actually able to meet a couple of neighbors yesterday that I wouldn't have met otherwise because they were helping push my car, and then I was helping snow plow other cars out. So it was kind of nice. I wouldn't want it every day, but it was kind of nice to see all the pretty white and then also to meet some neighbors. So gave me a chance to actually, you know, be a good neighbor. I got my snowblower and I snowblowed this guy's driveway. And he said, hey, I've got a gift card I'd like to give you. And I said, no. I can't think of a better way to meet a new neighbor than to snowblow his driveway. So we've got a great second hour coming up. Dr. David Stevens is going to be with us in just a minute. It's 6 minutes after the hour. Nice to have you here. I'll be back in a minute. Good morning. It's 7 minutes after the hour. Dr. David Stevens, frequent guest and friend, is from the Christian Medical and Dental Association and is with us now on our Skype line. Good morning, David.
Good morning. How are you? Besides cold.
It's cold and snowy, but it's an authentic Minnesota blasting blizzard. And so you only get those every once or twice a year, so they're not bad.
Yeah, a good experience, and as you say, opportunity to meet new people and all commensurate with each other.
It's really true. I met two new neighbors, so you know it was kind of nice.
Great.
Well, I found this so fascinating, David, that there's now this religious freedom discussion. Do healthcare workers can they refuse services based on religious beliefs?
According to the law, you can, and it's for, you know, often people on the other side portray this, well, you just don't like these people. You just don't want to serve them. And that's not what healthcare right of conscience is about. It's not refusing to treat because you don't like or approve of a patient or their beliefs or attitudes or behavior. It's exercised when a healthcare professional is being asked or required to participate in or facilitate some way an action they believe violates their ethical, moral, or religious beliefs. And that would be like doing abortion or helping with physician-assisted suicide. Or a Catholic colleague may say, for religious reasons, I don't prescribe contraceptives. You'll have to find that from another healthcare professional. So that's the type of issues we're talking about. This isn't about discriminating against people. It's when we become morally complicit by doing something that the patient requires us to do that violates our conscience.
Why aren't we more civil and kind and saying, well, if it violates your conscience, help me find someone that can help me get what I want? Why do we have
about tolerance is tolerate everything but the belief that something is true. And
right.
And because you believe something is true, then that upsets me. And so I'm going to coerce you to participate. in this. And that's what's happening, unfortunately, in our country. And we've had lots of people this happened to that are healthcare professionals. A nurse in New York City forced to participate in abortion, threatened her license, threatened to fire her. And a group of nurses came in New Jersey, and they found out that they were going to have to help with abortions. And that was the new rule because the hospital was expanding their abortion service, and they were Catholic and didn't want to do it. And it, the list just goes on and on, even just for speaking, much less refusing to provide. We have a member who's a faculty member at a major medical school, and he spoke out on the dangers of transgender behavior, the increased incidence of suicide, 10 times higher for people that experience this. And if they go through transitions, it's actually 19 times higher. And he said that in a public forum at the Heritage Foundation, came back and they demoted him and took away his departmental position, and essentially you're trying to force him out of the medical school. Another Catholic doctor at the same meeting, same thing happened to him at another medical school. So this is a real issue, and the goal of those on the other side of a lot of these issues is to push Christians out of healthcare. And I've had a Planned Parenthood lawyer tell me that to my face on national public radio. If you're not willing to do this, you shouldn't be in healthcare.
Wow. So, David, where will this mandate come from? Will this be the Department of Health and Human Services? Does this come from the president? Where will some of these where will some of this come from?
We've had over 25 laws on the books to protect right of conscience, not completely enough, but, you know, on abortion, sterilization, physician-assisted suicide, and other things like the Weldon Amendment, the Church Amendment, that have to be renewed every year in legislation. But the trouble is there's been no enforcement. And so, I mean, how fast would you drive if there weren't any enforcement of speed limits? I'd have to confess I'd probably go over the speed limit more than I do. And that's what's happened. There's no penalty. So this new Conscience and Religious Freedom Division is actually in Health and Human Services. There's a 200-page regulation that says this is exactly what these laws mean, and here's what we expect. You're going to have to certify to us when you're getting funding from us that you're not discriminating. We have investigative powers. We have punishment powers. If you continue to cross these lines, there's going to be consequences in your Medicaid funding, your Medicare funding from the U.S. government.
Wow.
If you participate in this program. So for the first time, there's teeth. You know, all those instances that I gave you of people being discriminated against, groups like Alliance Defending Freedom or Beckett Fund went to court with them, and they were turned away saying, well, you have no right to sue. You have no right of private action. Health and Human Services hasn't taken any steps. So sorry, you just have to put up with it. Mm. And now there's some teeth in these laws, which have been needed for over 40 years.
David, how would all this affect the future doctors of America?
Let me give you an example from this week. I had a note from a very bright student saying she wanted to go in neurosurgery, and she was doing a rotation on neurosurgery, sent an email to her attending, the head of the department, and he pulled her aside and let me just fill you in on something. You have under your name on your emails that you're president of the Students for Life group here at our university. You better take that off or you won't get into a residency.
Wow.
You better not say that you're part of the Christian Medical and Dental Association or you won't get into any residency in the United States. So this discrimination is invidious. I mean, people are being selected and losing training opportunities, losing promotions, losing jobs. We had one of our members testify at the news conference at Health and Human Services last week. And she's a nurse midwife, and she finished her training, wanted to help the poor, went to a clinic in Tampa that dealt with the poor and applied for a position as a midwife. And she had put on her resume that she's a member of the American Pro-Life OBGYN Association. And they turned around to her and said right to your face, sorry, because you're part of this, we aren't going to take you through the interview process, and told her she couldn't have a job. And
wow.
So this discrimination on the basis of religion, which is protected by the First Amendment, is being violated all over the country.
I remember when I did my rotation on neurosurgery and I didn't have to deal with this. How did this doctor respond when she was told she had to take this off?
She was asking me for advice. I actually wrote her a long email about it and said, you're going to have to ask God's guidance because it is happening and it may keep you out of neurosurgery. And so you're going to have to decide whether you're going to stand up and let this be known or wait, get into the residency, then let your pro-life views be known. I remember in residency, this is years ago, back in the 70s, my head of OBGYN said I had to write a letter explaining to her why I wouldn't do abortions if I was going to be exempted. And I was pretty forward even then, and I wrote her a sweet letter back but said, listen, I'm happy to do that as soon as the students that are doing abortions, residents, are writing you a letter and explaining why they're doing them. And then I determined I was going to be the best resident she ever had and ended up being the chief resident in OBGYN and did great service. But this is terrible what's happening in this country. And it's terrible for our listeners because you want a physician or a nurse that shares your worldview. And that becomes more and more important with physician-assisted suicide and abortion and other things that are happening. And yet there's an attempt to drive all pro-life religious physicians out of healthcare, nurses and others. And, you know, essentially the government dictates what you have to believe if you're going to be in healthcare.
I don't like that. David, let me take a little break. When I come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. David Stevens from the Christian Medical and Dental Association, and he is not ashamed at all to put that on his business card. We'll be back in a minute. Minutes after the hour, I'm speaking to Dr. David Stevens from the Christian Medical and Dental Association. David, 45 years ago, the Supreme Court issued its decision in Roe v. Wade, and since then, 59 million babies have been lost to abortion. And we, the U.S. still remains one of only seven countries that allows abortion after 20 weeks. Yet, despite all that, there is new hope, isn't there?
There is. In fact, the March for Life this past week really demonstrated that. The numbers are up. We're seeing lots of students. There's a group called Students for Life that we work with on campuses across the country. CMDA students that, you know, we're on 284 medical and dental school campuses across the country, kind of like a campus crusade or InterVarsity for medical and dental students and nursing students and others. And they were there marching. And tens of thousands of people showed up for the March for Life. Actually, the pro-life side was down in the number of people that were there, which is encouraging. So, and what we're talking about, protecting right of conscience and other things being done, not only it's just for healthcare professionals, there's discrimination by governments. California's requiring insurance companies, even all of them, to provide abortion services. So there's nothing available for churches and others without paying for abortion. There's a lot of things going on in the country, but we're beginning to see a shift as well. This is what's happening with Planned Parenthood and the efforts to get them defunded, which is the largest abortion provider in the country, over 300,000 to 400,000 abortions a year.
Mm-hmm. David, remind my listeners and equip them that science is pro-choice. I mean, pro-life.
Oh, it is.
I mean, pro-life.
Yeah, it is. Science is pro-life, and we now have, you know, 3 and 4D ultrasound. You can see the baby moving, sucking its thumb. We know the other side is even beginning to say, yes, human life begins at conception. But what they've done is to divide being a person from being a human being. So you're not a person until you have certain attributes, till you can feel pain or you have consciousness or you know you exist or whatever. Just things they pick out of the air and say, okay, well, it may be a human life, but we can destroy it because it's really not a person that's protected under the Constitution. And that's this artificial dualism that mind and body can be separated, which is not the case. And it underlies much of what's happening in a lot of other areas, from abortion to the hookup generation to all these type of things. And Nancy Piercy's got a wonderful new book on that called Love Your Body, and talks about this dualism and how it affects all these issues that we're dealing with, and that we're not looking at people as unified wholes. We're looking at them as the body and separate from the mind, and dualism. And we get into a whole kind of problem that leads to the issues we're talking about today, and that's an abortion. This is not a person. So it's all right to kill it. Yes, it'll come a person when. Well, there's no scientific point that someone becomes a person. It's just whoever has the power to decide that. And that's what happened in Roe versus Wade.
Mm-hmm. I found it interesting, just to switch topics here a little bit, about the overwhelming response in California hospitals with the flu and the seriousness of this particular strain. And I thought, I always thought that the cold and flu was more of the cold winter region, but not necessarily, huh?
It's not. You tend to get it more often in the winter because you're inside, you're enclosed with other people, and the spread of these viruses is much more in colder areas.
Okay.
But if it's virulent enough, you can get it anywhere, and that's what's happened this year. People get flu more in the north usually than in the south, but not always. And this year it's all across the country. And it's been very serious. People are dying. Even young people are dying.
Mm-hmm. And then the strain of it that I read about in California, where the hospitals are just getting absolutely overwhelmed. Again, let me ask, is it wise or not wise to get a flu shot?
It is wise. And even
is
if it doesn't
late?
Protect you, no. It only takes a week or 10 days to become effective. And actually, the peak for the flu season is usually February or March. So if you haven't got one, I go get one. It looks like it's only like 10 to 30% effective in preventing it. But if you do get it, it'll be less serious if you've had the flu shot. So it's well worth getting, especially if you have a chronic disease, you're older and young. But it's recommended for young children down to almost the infant stage, the toddler stage, clear up to everyone. So get your flu shot. You don't want to get this. We just had almost one of the mothers of one of my staff members die with the flu last week.
Oh, my. Wow. David, here's another question I have for you. If you are having trouble sleeping and you've got maybe several weeks, or maybe you've stacked up a month or two of bad sleep, what does the doctor recommend for trying to get back on a rhythm of more sleep?
Yeah, there's a lot of advice in that area. One is to what we call sleep hygiene, and that's going to bed at the same time, not drinking any caffeinated beverages after lunch, getting exercise, especially mm-hmm. in the evening. Lots of things you can do. Get in bed. Don't stay in bed if you can't sleep. Get up, read, mm-hmm. do something, and go back to bed. So bed is for sleeping. And then you can, if it still doesn't solve the problem, see your doctor. There's some ways they can help induce sleep without causing addiction or anything like that. But often these sleep hygiene things are going to happen. People just don't realize how much caffeine they're drinking or how much they're worrying or dealing with stress and have to deal with the underlying issue. Not able to sleep is the symptom, not the cause.
Yeah, let me ask you a question. Is 2 gallons of coffee too much? Because if it is, I got some issues.
I know. It probably is, and we have more energy drinks, a lot of caffeine. I'm the same way. I got the work this morning, drank a cup of tea. I'll have a soda this morning, but I've stopped drinking them after about mid-afternoon because if I don't, I have trouble sleeping.
Yeah, and then you mentioned exercise. You didn't mean in the evening, did you? I mean, isn't that a bad habit to get too excited or too energized in the evening? Shouldn't you be trying to quiet down?
Anytime you can get exercise is good. And
okay.
I mean, I'm not talking about 10 o'clock at night, but I exercise towards the end of the day at work. We have half an hour we provide for staff to exercise. I do that the last half hour of the day. We have a gym here in the office. And then I'll go for another 15, 20 minutes and do an hour or more on weekends. And I feel better. I sleep better. I have more energy and, you know, start slow and build up and do both aerobic and anaerobic exercise, lift weights a little bit, mainly exercise your heart, treadmill. And during the winter, when you got snow like you do in Minneapolis, go up and down steps in a building if you don't have a gym. There's
Good
lots
point.
Of ways you can get exercise.
Good point. David, thank you so much for being on the show. Always look forward to our conversations and have a wonderful day.
God bless.
God bless you, David. It's 26 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break and be back in a minute. Good morning. It's half past the hour. Coming up next, Ron Deal. I think his middle name is Big. Ron Big Deal is going to be with us. We're going to go to news, though, first. Be back in a minute. We'll be right back. 25 minutes until the top of the hour. Steve Ferrara spells just the way it sounds. He's the author and founder of Men's Leadership Ministries. He says when you find yourself in a wilderness season, and we all do, he says it's essential to read your Bible often.
When we go through these wildernesses, we can't close our Bibles. We have to open our Bibles. And I have found that at times I am not thinking straight. I'm in the wilderness, you get worn out, you get fatigued, you get exhausted. And you might know truth, but you're just not assimilating it. So I cannot close my Bible. I have to open my Bible. And if nothing else, just go to the Psalms and just start flipping through the Psalms and say, Lord, show me, give me something here, Lord. Give me something right now. I need manna for my heart and my mind. Because to me, primarily, the Christian life is thinking. When you stop thinking, you're in trouble. Feelings are important, but they can't be central. Jesus in Isaiah said, come, let us reason together. What is true about God? This is how I feel about God, but what is true? What has he said to me? What has Jesus promised to me? I have to hold on and grasp that when I have nothing else left. He has promised to me, and the Bible doesn't say that God doesn't lie. It says he cannot lie. He's watching over his word to perform it. Well, when's he going to perform it? I don't know. But until he performs it and gets me out of this, he will sustain me in it and give me grace.
Those are some good words from Steve Farrar, F-A-R-R-A-R. You can check that interview out in its entirety at myfaithradio.com. Next up, Ron Deal is going to be with us, so stay tuned. Be back in a minute.
Are you having a tough time connecting with your team? Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. Your son or daughter is communicating with people all the time, with text and IM and Facebook. But my question is this, are you connecting with your team? Take the initiative to spend time with your child, to engage in a way that goes deeper than their mobile device. Don't wait for them to pursue you. It may never happen. Take the initiative. Make a date to have a conversation, the time to spend together, though it won't always seem like it's profound or life-changing. It will have a lasting positive impact. So make it happen. Today, choose to connect with your teen.
Having trouble parenting your teen in today's rapidly changing culture? Get instant access to Mark's new free parenting course online at freeparentingcourse.com.
Thank you, Paul and John. 21 minutes until the top of the hour. Ron Deal from Family Life Blended is on our Skype line, and we're going to be talking a little bit with Ron today about, again, the idea of the technology addiction that kids have, and maybe parents do too. So if you have a question for Ron, you can start getting it fired up right now. Give us a call at 877-933-2484. Good morning, Ron. How are you?
I'm good, Bill. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. You know, I was thinking about if everyone was walking around biting their fingernails, at some point we'd go, ooh, this could be a problem. Everyone has got their fingers in their mouth biting their fingernails. There's going to be problems with germs and teeth and everything else. But everyone's walking around looking at their phone for the most part.
Yeah, and we're touching it, what, a couple hundred times a day, as they say. And,
ooh, yeah.
And, yeah, it's, you know, kind of the center of the universe.
Yeah,
for a lot of us. Yeah.
And then Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, said, we have to limit our children on social media. Huh, where is social media? Oh, it's on your phone and your tablet, thing he sells.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a bit of a double message, isn't it?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, we don't, you know, everybody needs to be cautious. You are hearing that some from Facebook, you know, they're trying to show that they're conscientious about the impact that social media is having on people, and Tim Cook, as you mentioned, and yet at the same time, they desperately want us to buy it. It's a little bit like when the tobacco companies, you know, are forced into saying, hey, tobacco's not good for you, but buy ours.
Right.
You know, it's definitely there, and it's we understand business. We understand that's in their interest to try to sell us a product and get us connected to it. And I think we're learning more about the intentionality even early on of the programmers who were you know, making the smartphones, realize that that little ding on your phone is addictive. You do get a bit of a dopamine rush every time you hear that little bell saying you have a message or a text or something. And it draws your interest. It draws your attention. It keeps you constantly looking for what's the next thing. You know, at the end of the day, Bill, I've thought about this a lot. I've thought about it in my own life. I've got two boys, you know, 23 and 19, and, you know, this is very much integrated into their entire universe. And it comes down to that age old, do I have the self-discipline to set it aside? Why should it be any different than that? I mean, at the end of the day, it's like anything else. It's like chocolate cake. Do I have the self-discipline to set it aside and not go back to that? And, you know, that's kind of where we end the conversation, I think.
Ron, I want our listeners to know that you and I are not hard up for subjects to come up with to talk about. We revisit this frequently because of the serious nature of it, because kids are forming their identity at this mm-hmm. time in life when they may not be paying as much attention to God's word because they're trying to see how many people liked the last comment they made.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't remember the stats exactly, and I think maybe we've even talked about this before, but I think average today in America, the average kid is getting their first smartphone at age 10 mm-hmm. or 11, mm-hmm. and there's a fairly high percentage of children that are getting one around age 6 or 7. My wife is a kindergarten teacher. She teaches 5-year-olds, and I can tell you that many of them are incredibly savvy as it relates to smartphones.
Right.
Some of them have their own. I think that's really not discerning of parents. You wouldn't, you know, we're constantly trying to say to our kids, don't eat too much sugar. You know, all right, 2 cookies, that's enough. You're done for the night. You know, we have to police our children's behavior because we are smart enough to know that there are certain things that are addictive is a strong word, but you get the idea that it draws them in, it grabs their attention, it holds them. And we're not doing that very well when it comes to technology. I think part of us, you know, smartphones are only 10 years old. I don't know about you, but I still feel like, wow, this is a cool new thing. And we love giving our kids new things, sharing with them the latest and the greatest. And so we're a little drawn into that and infatuated with it as well. So we're not stopping to think maybe it's not wise to give a 10-year-old a smartphone.
Yeah.
I'm telling you from a counselor's point of view, I don't specialize in working with pornography, but I know people who do. And they are telling me we are just on the cusp of seeing the big tidal wave of pornography addiction because so many kids inadvertently are being exposed to that through their technology at younger and younger ages, and it is going to latch onto them so incredibly powerfully
yeah.
that in 10 more years from now, we're going to have this tidal wave of pornography addiction.
Yeah. All right, Ron, let's move on to the topic of the morning, which I really wanted to discuss with you, and that is creating boundaries and showing love if we have a prodigal child.
Mm.
How do we create these boundaries and yet show love and tender and mercy and compassion when we've got the prodigal child?
Yeah, okay, so let's talk around this because this is a hard subject, and I have a great, great compassion for people, parents, friends who are in a situation where somebody they care about has moved away from the Lord or, you know, something's going on in their life. And so they are not really walking with Christ. First of all, this hurts us as people who are family members, friends. We our kids, man, it hurts us deeply. We want them to come back. We care for them so much. Obviously, we believe that walking with the Lord is important, so we want that to be a part of their life as well. As we talk around this, Bill, I think one of the things we have to acknowledge is that sometimes our hurt comes off as disappointment. It's not that we're offended, hurt. Well, I guess some people feel offended. They might use that word. They're just scared. You know, we're scared for our kid. We're scared for our friend who's walked away from the Lord, turned their back. And so that hurt becomes disappointment, becomes I'm mad at you, and now I'm going to do something to try and we just get twisted here, right? This is what we should not do. Mm-hmm. We cut ourselves off. We move away from them. Sometimes, you know, we call it boycotting. No, I'm not going to spend time with you until you come back to Jesus. I mean, that doesn't really work. You know, we got to acknowledge that that is not the approach to take. We get twisted up because we don't want to give the wrong message. So I think the posture that we should have is moving toward that person. We move toward the prodigal. We don't move away from the prodigal. But we feel kind of strange, like if I move toward them, is that somehow condoning their behavior? Is that somehow blessing their behavior? That's where this conversation of boundaries comes in. I think it's possible to say to somebody, you know, if I were to just say to you, Bill, you know, you're a good friend and I care about you. And because I care about you, I want you to know that, man, I love us talking. I love us, you know, getting on the phone and connecting, and I want to continue to spend time with you. But I don't really feel good about some of the choices that you're making. I'm not going to join you in those choices, but you're still my friend. Mm. That is a delicate little line to walk, isn't it? Right? It's hard, and we don't always know when it's time to kind of take a step back or move a little closer. It's challenging, but I think that's the delicate line that we have to try to walk in order to keep our influence. Here's the reason, and then I'll stop.
Yeah. Let me pause you here because we're a little bit over our time, but I want you to hold that thought. And including when we come back, I want to ask you about what a parent or grandparent should not do in response to their prodigal child's actions. It's 13 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll be back with Ron Deal in a minute. It is 10 minutes until the top of the hour. I'm speaking to Ron Deal, whose middle name is probably either Big or Real. Not sure which one. Which one is it, Ron?
Or the best. The best.
Yeah. You ever go into a car dealership and go, I am here to cut my best deal. My name is Ron Deal. Scare some guy half to death. Anyway, before we went to break, we were talking about the posture that a parent would have towards a prodigal child. Continue that thought, if you would, please.
Yeah. What we don't do is withdraw mm-hmm. ourselves emotionally, physically, and what we need to do is try to move toward them to whatever degree they'll allow us. Here's the bottom line. We want to keep our influence, and influence is a function of distance, the emotional distance in the relationship, and it's a function of the direction of the two people. Let's think about the prodigal son story for just a moment. You know, the father's face was always toward the son. But at one point when the son turned his back to the father, we got a direction problem. The son's walking away. He's looking away. He's not looking at the father. That's hurting the father's influence. The farther the son goes, that's the distance between them, the less influence the parent has, the father has in that story. But on the day that the son turns around, well, we've just improved direction. That's improved, but we still got a lot of distance between the two of them. But things are looking up, right? And then the son eventually moves closer and closer. The distance is getting smaller and smaller. And what happens? The father's influence is constantly going up, every little step there, to the point that eventually he's able to reconcile the relationship and invite the son back home. But here's what never changed in the story of the prodigal son. The father's face never stopped facing the son. There are people out there who, when their child steps away from the Lord, they get offended, they get hurt, and they say, fine, I'm turning my back on you. That's never the thing to do. We lose our influence. We lose our ability to capture the other person's heart, to try to be there in moments when they're struggling, and they may have to pay some price for some choices that they make and have consequences. Are we there? Are we facing them so that we can step in that moment of consequence with compassion, not judgment, not go, I told you so. If you hadn't have made this choice, you wouldn't be suffering. No, but with compassion to say, I'm here. I know this is hard. I'm here. I'm still here for you. That's what the father needs. That's what we need to remember from the story of the prodigal son. The father's face never stopped facing the child.
Wow, that is a very strong image, Ron. Let's continue to talk a little bit about what a parent or a grandparent should not do. I mean, obviously we shouldn't withdraw, but I wonder if there isn't any other things that we need to pay attention to or be careful of.
Yeah, the other one I would say is, so don't withdraw yourself emotionally and don't try to punish them in your anger, in your hurt, in your disappointment. Well, what does punishment look like? You know, it's funny. People do things like, well, we're going to stop X, Y, Z. You know, we're having Thanksgiving, but you're not invited. You know, we come up with all these little, and what are we trying to do? We're trying to get leverage. We're hoping that somehow that will make the other person rethink their position, their choices, and that they'll change and repent. I just don't see that working. I mean, when has that ever really helped? Somebody who is already making prodigal choices to now punish them for those choices in a way that is manipulative, well, that just feels controlling, and it makes us look bad. It makes our faith look bad. That's not the answer, right? It's a hard thing to stay close in relationship with somebody who is a prodigal and not at the same time just, you know, bless their choices.
So, Ron, how do we do self-regulation in our own self-care when part of you wants to become Homer Simpson and go, why, you little?
Yeah. Oh, that's an excellent question. And what I would say is you need a lot of support on your end of things. Like, so if you're a single parent, my goodness, don't go this alone. Find some friends, find a mentor, somebody, grandma, somebody to talk to and get support from. Married couples can talk to each other, and I call it bleeding on each other. You know, we just pour out your heart to one another about what you're feeling inside. And you've got to, you do feel disappointed. You do feel hurt. You do feel afraid for your child. You got to share that with somebody. You don't share that with your child, right?
Yeah. So, Ron, if we're supporting a prodigal child because we're trying to show them our face and we're trying to support them, is there a boundary where we're crossing over, where we're enabling them to be sinning?
Yeah, absolutely. And those are the tough places where you make choices about what you can do. For example, I think you can say to a child who's living in your basement, not holding down a job, but is, you know, wandered away from responsibilities and faithfulness, I think you can say to that child, look, I love you, and that's never going to change, and you're welcome here for dinner, but you're getting a job or you're getting out of this house, right? You can say both things, and I think that is what people sometimes get confused about. They feel like, oh, I've got to take a hardline position, which means I'm essentially saying, I'm withdrawing myself from you. No. Move toward them as you set the boundaries. That's where the power is. You move toward them emotionally. You confirm and affirm their value to you and how much you love them. And then you say, but I'm not going to finance your irresponsibility. So here's the choices you have.
Yeah. Ron, with just a minute left, I mean, at some point a parent says, if you don't make your bed, you're not going to Jimmy's birthday party. And that worked.
Yep.
So when do you stop? When do you realize that this is not going to work anymore, whatever consequences you try to bring into their life?
Boy, I wish that was an easy black and white answer. I don't know that I can say definitively, here's how you know. I think you give it, you know, sometimes we extend lots of mercy and go the extra mile and the extra mile and the extra mile. At some point, you have to step back from that and say, clearly, this was not a temporary thing, that this is my efforts to go the extra mile are now part of the problem. It takes some perspective to recognize that. I think it's fine for parents to err on the side of going the extra mile, but at some point you do have to back up and go, all right, we're not helping. We've got to change our tactics. And really what you need to do at that point is to stop trying to get them to be different, and you just need to be in charge of your time, your space, your resource.
Yeah.
It's our home, and you're not going to live that way.
Now, I got to run, but I want to continue this conversation. I think we've just sort of opened a door that's still a lot of things to discuss on this. So next time we're on, let's devote some time to continuing this conversation. Speaking to Ron Deal from Family Life Blended, we'll take a short break and wrap up the show in just a minute. Praise the Lord, oh my soul, all my inmost being, praise his holy name. Have a great day. Nice to be back. I'll see you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show. Connecting.